no press. So this is, obviously anyone else on this call will hear you. If you have any questions or things that you want to ask directly, feel free to email either myself, your account manager, or sales@s3.com. All right, let's get started. I'm going to start with a disclaimer. So just to understand, this presentation represents our understanding as of today. This may change, right? Either with information from the SEC, from FINRA, or other industry discussions. This is not a complete review of the FAQs. It's a synopsis of the things we consider most important for you, our clients. And this is not legal advice nor regulatory advice. Please talk to your compliance and legal teams for their official interpretation. So where are we today? As we all know, compliance date is August 1st. That was extended from December 14th, 2025. That still stands. The odd lot best available display price currently stands at November 1st, 2026, which is 6 months following the entry of the best available display price on the SIP, which we should see going live in a week and a bit. And of course, on April 1st, 2026, the reason for this presentation, the SEC finally published the FAQs that we had been waiting for. Okay, this webinar is organized by priority. It is not organized by the FAQs. We're not going to go through all the FAQs. We're going to go through the ones that we believe are most important to you and to our clients in general. And we'll look through, first of all, go through who is required to report because that came up. Talk about the various changes that were codified and finish with sort of just a quick review of the carried over FAQs. And then, of course, questions and answers. Probably best to leave those till the end if possible. All right. So we'll start with who needs to report. Existing scope. Right now, we know market makers, exchange specialists, ATSs, national securities exchanges, they've been in play. Larger broker dealers, as we know, 100,000 or more customer accounts, single dealer platforms. And then the firm performing multiple functions produces one per function. Let's get into that. The first update that we got was ATSs with IOC flow, and it centers around the definition of not held. SEC has clarified what not held is and that it requires price and time discretion. An ATS generally does not exercise price or time discretion, and therefore, if an ATS receives an IOC order that is an IOC order notably is pegged is sorry not pegged an IOC order notably has no ability to have discretion and therefore for 605 purposes should be considered held. This is a question that we've had for a while. This has been clarified. Later in the conversation, we'll discuss specifically about how PEG orders work, because I know certain ATSs accept only PEG, some IOC, and some not. Feel free to call sales@s3.com if you have not been reporting a 605 previously. We'd be happy to help. Retail brokers that internalize fractional shares. As expected, the SEC is requiring this. If you are a retail broker that exceeds the 100,000 account minimum, then you do need to report both a 605 for your retail trading activity and a 605 for your OTC market making activity, which is the fractional component. We had a few questions about this regarding posting quotes or profiting from the spread. The SEC rejected those and said you do need to create that separate report. That said, they also did provide one exemption, and this is both in the FAQs and an explicit exemption, which is that if trades occur as a result of a DRIP or a stock dividend, then you are not required to produce that second 605 report. So effectively what this means is that if your clients enter into a position as a result of a dividend reinvestment program or via a stock dividend directly, then you are exempted from creating an OTC market maker 605 report. And that means when they exit the position. Generally, the situation here is that they enter the position as a not held order because they don't control when that happens. But the exiting of the position is a held order. That exit is not required to be reported. No, sorry. If you do not have any other mechanism by which you trade fractional shares, you do not have to have an OTC market maker report. So that trading is still required to show up on your standard 605 report, your retail broker report. And if you allow fractional trading in other circumstances, you are expected to produce the second OTC market maker report, and this trading should be included in that, because it is a way that, effectively, because clients can exit their position in a fraction directly. It doesn't only have to be a liquidation of a final position. Again, since I've got 50 odd slides, I'm going to go through, and then we can talk about questions in at the end. So the impact across the reporter population is that is ATS is accepting only IOC or not held flow, or indeed, if you are an ATS that accepts any IOC orders, then those are going to be included now. Retail brokers trading fractionals have the have that second requirement. Feel free to talk to us. We can help you identify what your needs are. Okay, now into the actual issues at play. The biggest thing that we felt was impacted was GTC orders. Previously in 605, GTC orders were excluded. These were not covered following the first day of life. That has changed, and the SEC did accept the FIF's advice on how to accomplish this. So when you place a GTC order, the way I've explained it is you consider it a series of day orders. So when it starts life, you treat it exactly the same as you would any other day order. If it enters life as marketable, it gets reported as marketable. If it enters life as non-marketable, you wait to see if it reaches executability. And just a point of clarification, because I know this has come up as a question. Executability is a near side. So basically, you get a near side match that determines executability for limit orders. And marketability is based on the far side. If a GTC order is marketable on day one, it's handled the same as it would be any other day, the same as any other day order. If it is enters life as a non-marketable limit, it is treated like any other non-marketable limit order. Now, on subsequent days, the way to treat it is as a day order where the order was received prior to market open. So it functions exactly the same as any other prior to market open order on following days. There are no restrictions on months. It can cross months, it can cross days. There are no changes to that. So let's go through what that means. So first off, if a trade occurs outside of regular trading hours, so if you execute 100 shares after hours on a 500 share order, that will reduce the open quantity that is carried into the next trading day. And again, this is exactly the same as any other order that is received prior to market open. And so the order itself is still eligible to be 605 covered. So imagine if you have a 500 share good till cancel buy limit, non-marketable, non-executable at $30.50 received at 3:58 p.m. on April 30th. During regular trading hours, 300 shares are executed. Sorry, let's say it hit executability. During that day, 300 shares are executed. That will be reported on the April report. 100 shares then execute after the close. Those shares will not be included on your April report. So your April report will have 300 shares You'll have a 500 share order with 300 shares executed on your April 30th report. Now, that will have 100 shares remaining that will move over into May. One possible outcome is that the shares execute during the opening auction, that they are marketable and execute during the opening auction. Because this represents a outside of market hours trade, this is not covered, and therefore this is the end of life for this GTC order. So the only 605 report that you will have is in April for the 500 share order, 300 shares executed. Another scenario is it may not execute at the open, but it is marketable. Once again, because marketable orders received prior to market open are excluded from 605, this order would be excluded. Now, a caveat here is even if it begins life as marketable, but then does not execute, it is still eligible to continue life the next day. So if on May 1st it opens, your order is marketable, it does not trade for the remainder of the day, then that order is still eligible to continue life the following days. The fact that it was marketable does not end its life for subsequent days. It just ends its coverage for that day. Then the third outcome is that it is a non-marketable order. And in this case, if it becomes executable on May 1st, then you now have a 100 share order that became executable on May 1st. Again, like with the marketable scenario, if it does not execute, it will be eligible for the same thing the following days. So each day, a good till cancel order, any good till cancel orders that remain open at the beginning of the day should be treated exactly the same as any order that was placed outside of market hours. Pause for a second to let that sink in, but like I said, I don't want to get sidetracked yet, so please note your questions and we'll talk about them in a few minutes. All right. The next, what I felt was the most important thing in our questions was stop orders. And the SEC addressed several of these: stop limit executability, how effectively downstream routing, and if they're covered. So the first thing I want to discuss is the non-marketable stop is a stop limit order. So the SEC, when they initially published the rule, stated that a order with a stop price becomes executable when the stop price is reached. We challenge this because a stop limit order should require both the stop price to be triggered and then the limit price to be met. And so the SEC did accept that. And so a stop limit order does not become executable until both the stop price is met and, excuse me, and the executable and the limit price is hit. So, for example, you have a sell, and this is directly from the SEC. I've taken off the microseconds and things, but you have a sell stop limit day order. The stop is $15, the limit is 16. At 2:31, the NBBO reaches 15 by 15:05, and in this case, we're triggering off the bid, so the stop now comes into existence and is live. But the limit price has not been reached, and therefore this order is not yet executable and not yet covered. At 3:14 p.m., the NBBO hits 15:95 by 16, and so at this point, the order becomes executable, and therefore it is now covered. Once again, you see that the word here is executable. This is a scenario where our marketability, right? Marketability has not yet been reached, but executability has, and therefore this now falls under a non-marketable limit order that is covered under 605. The second example that the SEC brings up is exactly the same scenario as before, but in this case, the limit price never goes above, or the market never goes above a $16 ask, and therefore the order never becomes executable and it's not covered. Okay? So basically the key is that both the stop price and the limit price must be reached in order for an order to become covered. The next major issue that came up was if the way the SEC worded the rule, an order needed to be triggered. When a stop order was triggered, you needed to report that. But they did not allow for the scenario where a broker dealer does not know when the actual trigger occurs. They have given us the, basically they've allowed us to use market data to determine the stop triggering time. So if a stop order, if you write a stop order to a wholesaler, you're a retail firm, you write a stop order to a retailer, and the, you route to a wholesaler, the wholesaler triggers the actual order, you are now not required to get the actual triggering timestamp. We can do that for you based off market data. So as I said, basically we'll need to know what the stop times, what the stop type is, and we'll need to know the stop trigger price and sort of what the mechanism is for stopping. If you stop on print, if you stop on quote, if you stop on the better of print or quote, and we can handle those and determine whether your stop was triggered. All right. Moving on to pegged orders. Pegged orders became an issue because peg orders weren't really defined in the rule. A peg order represents an order that may move, even though it may end up at an ATS or an exchange. Because it is pegged, they do have a version of price time discretion, and therefore the SEC has considered any peg order, provided it is not IOC, as special handling instructions. So as long as a peg order is not IOC, the order is out of scope because the venue may adjust the price and time at which it executes. It does not mean it has to have done so. It simply means that it is possible for it to do so, and therefore it is out of scope. IOC pegs, on the other hand, as we saw in the ATS slide, IOC pegs are going to be in scope and included. And it's going to be based on the less aggressive price. So this was effectively, this was the SEC, you know, guiding us in how this should be determined as a limit order. So an IOC peg order obviously does not reprice. It has to execute immediately or be canceled. The example that the SEC gave was an IOC mid-peg limit, a mid-peg with no limit. The MBBO is 2051 by 2055. Therefore, this should be classified as a midpoint or better non-marketable limit order because the functional limit is the midpoint of 20 spot 53. Example 14.4 that they, or 14-4 that they give, same MBBO, so the midpoint is 20 spot 53. If it is provided with a limit price of 20 spot 52, it is classified as a midpoint at the it's classified as midpoint because the midpoint is less aggressive than the limit price. If it is a limit of 2055, then it's classified as a executable non-marketable limit because it's on the far side, or it's on the near side of the quote. And if it's 2056, then it is canceled immediately because that quote is never reached and it never becomes executable. And I will note there, since I said it is canceled, if an order executes without ever becoming executable, then that order would be excluded from 605 as well. It does not, just because an order executes, if it's outside of the quote, then it may not be included in 605. And this really stems from the SEC's acceptance that a order that executes at a price unrelated to the current NBBO is considered special handling. So for pegs, what we need is peg type, time in force, and any limit or cap price, and then we'll run the information for you. All right. Moving on to pre-open and opening auctions. So there are a few conversations that the SEC discussed around these. Pre-open marketability, pre-open limit orders marketability. The SEC did clarify that the marketability is determined. This was just a clarification. Basically, the SEC had a pretty they weren't careful in their definition here. So they basically have said the limit order received before the primary is open, it's determined at the primary's first on cross. There was a scenario where there was a discrepancy between pre-market and during the interim period. They clarified that. That's what this is. Now, the other issue, the other major issue that came up was the possibility of receiving a quote from the primary before an opening auction, right? Obviously, there are some exchanges where they don't open until they have an opening auction, but there are other exchanges where they may or may not have an opening auction. For 605 purposes, if an exchange has an opening auction, then the reference quote is the first quote following that opening auction. If it does not have an opening auction, then you look for the first quote on the primary. That basically, you know, obviously we'll take care of handling that for you. We will identify when the opening auction occurs and find the first quote from the primary on the market for that. Sort of discussed this in the GTC, but again, this GTCs effectively act the same way as a pre-market order. If an order is received prior to the market open and it only partially fills, then what should happen is the order should enter life as the leaves quantity. So in our example here, you receive a 500 share buy order with a limit price of 10.50 at 8 a.m., 200 shares executed at 8.20. The market opens at 10.55 by 11. So at this point, it is not marketable, and therefore it is eligible to become covered. Had it been marketable, then it would not be covered and it would be excluded completely. But because it is outside of the market, it is a non-marketable limit order and therefore may be covered. At 10:14 a.m., the NBBO hits 10:50 by 10:55, and therefore it is now executable as of 10:14, and therefore coverage begins at 10:14. All right, time stamping and the NBBO. There were three FAQs on time stamping and NBBO benchmark. The time of order receipt was a question that several firms asked. The answer is the moment the order is first captured in the firm's automated order handling system. So you can't do anything prior to the timestamp. I think, you know, the one question that has come up here is the idea of doing risk checks. And I think in many cases, those risk checks occur prior to entry in the automated order handling system. And therefore, you may be able to exclude those. I think this is very much a question that you're going to need to talk to compliance and legal to answer. That's not something where we have a lot of opinions. And, you know, whatever you sort of flag as the time of order receipt, that's what we will use as our reference. SEC restated that you must use the SIP timestamp. You must use the SIP. You can't use a local version. You can't use direct feeds. They did actually say this in the rule, but they also reiterated it in the FAQs. The next question was whether to use basically which NBBO to use, and this stemmed from legacy questions. Previously, the SEC allowed you to use any consistent quote. Thankfully, they're not allowing that anymore. They've restricted this, and so basically, the answer is you should use the quote, the NBBO in effect at the time that the millisecond begins, or the microsecond, or nanosecond, whatever you are reporting in, it is whatever the NBBO is in effect at that time. So you can't use the last of second or middle second or whatever. It is only what is in effect. So it's also not the first. So this is important to understand that you need, if a quote occurs, if you receive an order at timestamp dot 608, if a quote occurs in that 0.608 millisecond, that quote is not the quote that should be used. You should use any quote that was live at the start of the millisecond, so anything that occurred prior to 608. Marketable limit orders. This was an issue where the SEC said that for all limit orders, the notional value should be the shares time the limit price. We challenged this, basically saying that doesn't make sense for marketable limit orders. They accepted our challenge, and therefore, market and marketable limit orders will have the correct, what I would say is the correct notional, which is the market value as opposed to the limit value. All right, so that's sort of the end of the specific groupings. Let's talk about some of the other things they came up with. Best available displayed price. This was a question of whether we should include the NBBO in the best available displayed price column. The SEC said no. As of right now, you cannot include the best available displayed price. They did not say we cannot use the best available displayed, and since it will be available prior to the market going live, it's not required prior to the rule going live. It's not required in August. It will not be required until November, but they are not stopping you doing it. So you are allowed to fill the best available displayed price statistics, but you're not required to. I don't yet have an answer on what S3 standard will be, but we will, we'll certainly be looking for feedback on what clients desire us to do. Size improvement. So the SEC specified that size, basically anything that posts, their example here, I didn't like it because I feel like they missed the key question, as you can see by my comment there. So their example is that if you get a 1,000 share marketable order to buy at 10/12, the NBBO includes that. This is a marketable order, and 700 shares fill immediately, but then the 300 are displayed at the 10/12 price point. Only the 700 would count, and since our benchmark is the 200, which was available on the market at the time, the outsize count would be 500. I'll probably discuss this with FIF because my main concern is if it was at the offer in this case, then it fills later after having been displayed. Those should not be included because that does not seem like size improvement. But the way they have written this, it should be included, and therefore that would show as a 700 share size improvement, or sorry, an 800 share size improvement. So that's something that I think we will need some clarification on. I think they missed our point in asking this question. Relative fill rates. The cumulative shares executed regular way at prices that could have filled the order in force, capped at the order size. The question here was basically, should the time increment, be used. So when you enter it in a given millisecond, should any executions that occur within that millisecond be included in that, or should they be excluded so that you see market that may basically, since you don't know which of your which is which, you know, if you see an order for 100 shares on the market, and I think our example was, you know, Google or Apple or something, and there were like 21 100 share executions in a given millisecond, you can't tell which is your execution and therefore which order should be included. And so what the SEC has stated here is that all shares in the same millisecond should be included in that. Now, of course, if you're doing in nanos or micros, then it should be within that same nano or micro respectively. But basically, it's saying that everything should be included from the inclusive of the timestamps that the order was placed and executed or canceled. Straddle state. This has had some conversation. Effectively, if there is a straddle state going on during a Loyalty event, rather than excluding only one side, effectively a straddle state renders the whole all trades during that period non-covered, and therefore effectively then that can be ignored. There's a couple of reasons for this, but it makes it an easy decision. If a straddle state is entered, then all trading is ignored for, or all orders and trades are ignored for 605 purposes. You cannot become executable during that straddle state. You'd have to look after the straddle state. You can't become marketable, etc. Short sale orders. If you begin life when no price test restriction is in effect, you're fine. If a price test restriction occurs during the life of the order, anything that occurs after that can be excluded from the report, or is excluded from the report, sorry. Directed orders. We discussed this also on FIF. Basically, directedness is determined. Really, everything in 605 is determined at the parent level, and therefore directedness should be based on the parent level directedness. If a retail broker receives an order that says direct to NYSE, then that order should be excluded from their 605. If they then hand that off to a wholesaler with the same instruction of direct to NYSE, then the wholesaler would exclude that from 605 because they received it as a parent directed order. If the final, when it shows up at NYSE, it is no longer a directed order. It receives an order the same as any non-directed order, and therefore it would be included in their 605. So you basically look at whether the directed flag affects how you handle it to determine whether directedness changes, whether it's included or not in your 605 report. Share weighting. This was initially just basically a clarification. The language was imprecise in the rule because it was not a calculation, and so we asked the SEC to just clarify their language, and the answer was exactly as we expected. So there's not really a lot here, but it's good that the SEC clarified so that we wouldn't have any future discrepancies. All right, quite a few FAQs they carried over from the previous FAQs. I'm not going to read all of these, but basically, questions 10, 11, 15, 16, 17, 19, 20, 26, 27, 29, 30, 32, and 36 were just carried over from the 2001 and 2013 FAQs. Thankfully, the SEC rescinded the previous FAQs. They are now withdrawn, which is fantastic. This was a substantial problem we had in 606, so I'm very pleased to know that. Everything we can look at the April 1st, 2026 FAQs as our reference FAQs for all of 605 going forward. All right, so just a brief summary of what this means for you. By and large, most of this will be handled for you on the back end as an S3 client. You'll please work with your account managers to make sure that all of the information we need is provided. This should all be in there. It's the, you know, we may have scenarios where we need to add stop orders, but we no longer need the triggering, which we were concerned about and which we developed in some draft data feeds that some of you may have gotten. Ready to go on August 1st. So if you have any questions, please reach out to your account manager or me directly. And if you are not a client, please contact sales at s3.com. And with that, I will open up to Q&A.
Hey, Mark, it's Rory. I have a question going back to the fractional share exemption. So I know in the FAQs, they don't specifically call out fracs acquired to things like employee stock purchase plans or, you know, shares split if there's like a divorce or estate planning. The spirit of it seems like those types of transactions are similar to DRIP and would be excluded, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think I agree with you that that was the spirit, but the problem with that one in particular is that it was not just an FAQ, it was actually an exemption to the rule, right? And you know, in thinking about it as I've been doing the past few weeks, I think that's actually why it took them so long to get this through. It wasn't because of the other FAQs, it was because they needed to take the exemption through the full rulemaking process or through a more effectively it needed actual commission approval, whereas the FAQs are technically staff only. So I would say we need to try to get them to confirm that, because I completely agree with you that the intent of the intent is clearly that if you enter a position, if you can enter a position voluntarily, then you need another report. But if you can enter a position only non-voluntarily, that you are exempted, but unfortunately, they didn't actually put that in the exemption, and therefore, I would be hesitant to not make that second report until they opine on that.
Got it. Okay, helpful. And then what I didn't know, and I think you covered this earlier, is it's just that those I guess liquidation activities from acquiring those types of positions, they're excluded from the second report, but they still need the executions themselves still need to be included in the first report.
So hold on a second. That I think that's important. The fractions acquired from a DRIP are not excluded from either the first or the second report. The exemption is simply that if your firm only allows clients to obtain the fractions via that mechanism, that you do not have to create that second one. So if clients can go in and buy fractional shares without basically voluntarily, then those DRIPs still need to be included in both reports. And it's not the DRIP itself, right? It's
Yeah,
the
got it. But if
exit from the DRIP.
they're acquiring like the notional buying aspect, if we're doing that on an agency basis, is that excluded?
If you are not making the market, then I would say yes.
Okay.
Right? It's that's the question of if the actual fraction trades within your broker-dealer, like if you route that on to the wholesaler, then no, you would not have to do the OTC market maker. That would be the same as you know, your whole shares.
Okay.
But it will show up in the main whole the base 605 report at the
100%,
end.
yes.
Yeah,
Everything
okay.
will show up in the main base 605. All right, that's helpful. Sorry, I have one other question, not to
No,
hog up the time. So
sure.
on the going to the part where you talked about the GTC orders, right? You mentioned that it's when they become executable, right? So if you determine through your market data that today the order became executable, but that order doesn't actually execute until, say, tomorrow. I get from like the execution quality metrics perspective, you're measuring it versus the MBBO when it became executable today, I imagine. What about from a speed perspective?
Hold on a second. No, hold on.
Okay.
Let's so in your example there, right, if it became executable today but did not execute, then that would represent, let's say it's for 100 shares, just for argument's sake, right? That would represent 100 shares of ordered shares that did not execute. Tomorrow, you have to reevaluate everything, right?
Oh, because
So
everything starts over again. Okay.
correct, right?
Got it.
So it would show up as ordered but not executed today, and then tomorrow you would have to see whether it gets executable again. So basically nothing except the leaves quantity carries over from day to day. And this is a
Okay.
crazy complex. Like it, when you think about it that way, like I had a pretty long discussion with our dev team, sort of like rather than thinking in the sort of specifics, you need to really back out and just think of the abstract requirement, which is GTCs don't exist. The only thing that exists is day orders, and on any given day, a GTC becomes a day order with the leaves quantity being the order quantity that was placed prior to market open. And so if you think about it abstractly like that, that's how they intend for it to be. So one order for 100 shares could represent 3,000 shares on your 2,000, right? Not including weekends, right? Could represent 2,000 shares on your 605 because each day it becomes executable but then doesn't execute.
Got
Right?
it.
So every day that it shows up, you increment it every day that it shows up and becomes executable. You increment by one the order and by however many shares the number of placed shares.
Cool. Thank you.
Mark?
Yeah. Hey, Alan.
Alan Cox, yeah.
I know.
How long must a quote be live for in order to trigger or to make a limit order marketable or executable?
I don't think they addressed that in the FAQs. I don't remember seeing that. I will have to look and get back to you on that, but I don't think that was addressed in the FAQs.
No, I don't think it was. I was just wondering how, you folks are handling it.
I mean, from our perspective, if a quote hits it, it hits it, right?
So if it's there for like a microsecond,
It triggers, yeah.
it triggers. Okay, thank you.
Hey Mark, Jacek from HRT here. I have a question about stop orders. Does the new 605 or the FAQ address kind of what's in scope for a last sale eligible trade that can effectively trigger a stop? Because I know that in the current scheme, it's a little unclear about what can and cannot trigger. I'm wondering if going forward, there's like some standardization around that.
So the original proposing release, they had rules for what was triggering. And I think both FIF and SIFMA sort of basically said, look, that's not reasonable. Triggering should be done based on what we trigger off. And so the SEC has just said triggering. They haven't specified what can trigger it. And so I would say that it would be triggered based on whatever you use as the triggering metric, and that is sort of our intent to implement, is sort of whatever the triggering metric that you use is. Now, is this going to come up in FINRA audits later? Probably, right? We don't know the answer, but as of right now, the indication is that whatever you use to trigger should be the triggering metric.
So we would pass through to you the price and the timestamp of the trigger, essentially. Maybe just the timestamp.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Because you're, I mean, you're triggering, you are the ones actually triggering. So yes, you would pass that through to us. And that's what we'd use as the reference.
And just to make sure I understand correctly, that's different from today because you guys use your own market data to kind of calculate the trigger. Going forward, we're passing through the timestamp to you.
Okay, so that's where it depends. Basically, if you are the triggering broker,
Yep.
then you would pass that timestamp to us. If you are not the triggering broker, then we would use market data to do that. So basically, your retail clients, we will effectively guess when you triggered it on their behalf. But if you actually trigger it, then you send us that triggering timestamp, correct?
Okay. Thank you.
Problem.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apologies if this may have been covered. I was off the call for the last few minutes. But with respect to good till cancel orders, is it an alternative or would it be easier for us to just send a series of day orders to you rather than you trying to keep the book and looking for cancels or other adjustments to it? Is that something that's been discussed broadly?
Rob is on the call and maybe be able to. I think we handle both ways. I think we have clients that do both.
Yeah, we can handle it both ways. I mean, we have the order. We know it's a GTC, so we keep the book on it. So we keep track of all the events. So, I mean, if there's no reason to make any adjustments to what you're currently sending us today. So, I mean, because we can handle it. We've been handling it for you, from the get-go.
Okay, so however it's set up, you don't see a reason to flip it one way or the other. Okay.
No, because we'll put in the mechanisms that are, centric around 605 to handle that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Will this presentation deck be shared?
Sarah?
Yeah, we can send out the deck and the recording to everyone as long as you registered on that using that email I sent out, then I'll have your contact information and I'll send it out that way.
Cool. Great. Thank you so much.
All right. If there are no other questions, thank you very much for attending and feel free to reach out with any other questions you might have.
Bye.
Yeah.